Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is Side 2 of For the Record Program 345, titled Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Part 2, Nation Building in the United States. This is being recorded on January 27th of the year 2002, and we're going to continue with our analysis of the convergence of the political, military, foreign policy, and domestic policy aspects of the September 11th, 2001 terror attacks and related events, including the anthrax attacks on American media outlets and two key Democratic senatorial leaders. One of the key aspects of understanding the link between the economic, the political, the military, and the foreign policy, and the domestic policy or convergence with regard to the different aspects of analyzing the September 11th attacks, and that concerns petrodollars. We have spoken in past broadcasts about the historical links between the Saudi monarchy and the Third Reich, and in turn some of the business connections to international fascism, including the Bush family and their Third Reich links. In last week's program, 344, we looked at an apparent Saudi Bormann organization link through the Swiss financial milieu. What we're going to look at now is one of the central elements in the American political considerations with regard to the September 11th, 2001 attacks, and that concerns petrodollars, specifically Arab oil investment in the United States. As the Arab oil-producing countries have drastically increased petroleum prices from 1973 onward, bear in mind that Saudi Arabia gives the U.S. 20% of its oil and that they contain 25% of the world's proven petroleum reserves. This, in turn, has created an economic outflow in the United States. To counter that, American corporations have courted petrodollars, that is to say, recycled capital that originally was paid out by the United States to the Arab oil-producing countries, Saudi Arabia in particular, which in turn has then been invested in the United States. This literally constitutes Saudi and Arab economic imperialism in the United States, or colonialism would be a better way of putting it. And specifically, it is the American institutional and corporate connections to the petrodollar investment that has produced a distorting aspect in American foreign policy. I would also note that in the wake of the September 11th, 2001 attacks, we've been treated both in the United States and abroad to some very, very shrill scapegoating of Israel for the responsibility ultimately for that incident. In some cases, quite literally. I would note that Islamofascism, as I've called it in the past, is fed by the economic and social injustice in the various countries that house the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. And none of those countries are controlled by Jews, let alone Israelis. But throughout much of the world, including much of the Islamic world, and in the United States, we are hearing, to a large extent, Israel and Jews being scapegoated for the economic distress in the Islamic world and for the lack of social justice there, as well as for quite a few things in this country. In fact, leaving aside the historical connections of the right wing of the Israeli political spectrum to international fascism, which I've spoken about before, basically Israel has nothing to do with it. As I've said in the past, long story made short, last time you filled up your gas tank, did you fill it up with A, matzo ball soup, or B, gasoline? Figure it out. The American House of Saud. This book is authored by Stephen Emerson. It's subtitled The Secret Petrodollar Connection. It was published in hardcover by Franklin Watts. Copyright 1985. The ISBN number is 0-531-09778-1. What we're going to look at in this portion of this side is the effect on the American political landscape of the petrodollar investment. Stephen Emerson writes of the petrodollar investment, particularly that by Saudi Arabia, "A critical distinction has rendered petrodollar trade different from trade with other foreign nations. Unlike other foreign investments and export markets such as those of Europe or Japan, trade with the Arab world often comes with implicit political strings. Decisions regarding investments and trade are made by Arab leaders, government agencies, royal families, and businessmen. And because these decisions are made by the ruling elite or by officials inextricably tied to the government, Arab financial transactions have often been accompanied by a political dimension tied to foreign policy interests. Thus, unlike European transactions, which are made by private citizens with the exclusive economic purpose of profit or gain, the recycling of Arab oil dollars in the United States has often provided a conduit for the furtherance of Arab political goals. In the end, a vast ripple of petrodollar influence has washed over American society as business and politics have become intertwined. Not only has Saudi Arabia, as the largest and most powerful oil producer, been able to directly change American policy, but it has been able to cultivate supporters from all walks of American life. Tremendous leverage is wielded over companies, consultants, officials, and institutions doing business with Arab oil producers. Banks, law firms, energy and munitions companies, construction firms, retail manufacturers, farmers, think tanks, rice growers, bus companies, ambassadors, farm co-ops, public relations firms, and even former presidents have all become involved in varying degrees in pressing for the political interests of the Arab oil countries. Bear in mind, interjecting here, this book was published in 1985. It's gotten a lot worse in the years since this was published. Continuing, even prominent newspapers, universities, and television networks have become witting and unwitting vehicles through being adroitly manipulated for the promotion of the Arab political agenda. To the unsuspecting, the emergence of across-the-board understanding, unquote, and uncritical support for Arab political interests ranging from arms sales to television commentaries to university programs, and simultaneous and selective condemnation of Israel and the American Jewish community seems for the most part to be spontaneous. This appears as a function of disinterested political analysis, genuine intellectual and cultural inquiry, and an honest, objective assessment of the moral grays that dot the political landscapes of the Middle East. But in fact, a great deal of the sudden understanding, unquote, for and political support for Arab policies has little to do with independent political evaluations or even with exasperation at Israel's aggressive actions. The root cause is money. And through surreptitious political funding, manipulation of the political process, invisible political strings, hidden lobbying, and the dissemination of disinformation, the hidden hand of a vested petrodollar lobby has successfully and secretly affected the conduct of the American political process. Ironically, the willingness of American corporations and executives to do the bidding of Arab governments constitutes a reversal of the traditional, if unethical, role of multinational corporations. For years, American and other multinationals have broken international laws or have interfered in the affairs and policies of foreign governments, skipping down. Petrodollar trade, however, has created a reverse imperialism. Instead of trying to advance American, quote, interests, unquote, abroad, American corporations here became the pawns of Arab nations in trying to change American policies. In the 11 years since the Arab oil embargo, the oil weapon has been transformed into a money weapon. Arab oil dollars have become thoroughly diffused through American society, yet they have retained their political strings. From the Ford Motor Company to General Electric, from former Vice President Spiro Agnew to former President Gerald Ford, from Duke University to the University of Southern California, from Alabama Public Television to Time Magazine, from the North Dakota Legislature to the U.S. Senate, the influence of petrodollars has successfully and secretly changed the course of American politics. This is that untold story. And it is a very significant and long story indeed, and one that has grown more significant and much longer in the years since the book was published. But by way of making the proverbial long story short, we're going to take a look at some aspects of The American House of Saud by Stephen Emerson right now. In understanding the political heritage, and we've spoken about King Ibn Saud, his connections to Mohammed bin Laden, Osama's father, his connections to Alan Dulles, to the Third Reich, and through the Third Reich and Alan Dulles to the Bush family, we're going to take a look now at his son, King Faisal, under whose auspices the rise in petrodollars due to the drastic increase in oil prices took place. While OPEC radicalism was rising, King Faisal, the austere Saudi leader who succeeded to the throne in November of 1964, had become increasingly bellicose toward the United States and Israel. Faisal had never reconciled himself to the idea of a Jewish state and would routinely distribute to visitors copies of the notorious anti-Semitic forgery, the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Of course, that was a major influence on Adolf Hitler. It was also disseminated by the Grand Mufti-founded World Muslim Congress that was one of the major vehicles for the Afghan support effort against the Soviets in the 1980s. It was that Afghan support effort that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden and his Arab Afghans as a military force. What we're going to look at now is the lobbying on behalf of Saudi Arabia and the related Arab Americans Association by Robert Keith Gray, a Republican PR man, one of the central figures with the public relations firm of Hill & Knowlton. He also had strong connections to, among others, Edwin Wilson of Wilson & Turple fame, as we've looked at in the past. He is very closely connected to the Republican Party and to the elements in the Republican Party that are in power today. And his firm, Gray & Company, did a lot of lobbying on behalf of Saudi Arabia. Turning to the American House of Saud once again, of Robert Keith Gray, we read, Gray himself has unparalleled connections to the Reagan administration and to the Republican Party. A loyal friend, devotee, and supporter of Ronald Reagan, Gray was the director of communications for the Reagan-Bush campaign and wrote several widely circulated memos during the 1980 campaign detailing various strategies to defeat President Carter. After the election, Gray was made a co-chairman of the 1980 inaugural committee and hosted a lavish black-tie dinner in honor of Nevada Senator Paul Laxalt, President Reagan's close friend and confidant. The 62-year-old, elegant-looking, silver-haired Gray is on a first-name basis with every member of the Reagan cabinet, top White House officials such as Edwin Meese and Chief of Staff Jim Baker, and scores of senators and congressmen. Of course, James Baker, interjecting, handled the Florida recount for the younger George Bush. He eventually became the elder George Bush as Secretary of State and is a major player, along with the elder George Bush and to a lesser extent the younger George Bush, in the Carlyle Group, one of the business links connecting the Bushes to the Bin Ladens. Continuing. With one phone call, Gray can often schedule appointments on behalf of his clients with the chairman of powerful Senate committees and the heads of executive branch agencies. What we're going to look at next is a secret memorandum that was drafted by Gray and Company on behalf of some of the Arab organizations on behalf of which he lobbied, including the National Association of Arab Americans, closely linked with the Saudi petro lobby, so to speak, or petrodollar lobby. And bearing in mind King Faisal's espousal of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, bearing in mind also much of the screaming anti-Semitic rhetoric that we've been hearing in the wake of September 11th, masked as anti-Zionist rhetoric, consider this memorandum, and consider the between the lines hinting in this memorandum, and compare this with the type of dogmatic and medieval anti-Semitism that is contained in the protocols. Turning to the American House of Saud, a mammoth public relations proposal authored by Gray was being circulated with Saudi Arabia and American Arab organizations that, in the opinion of one highly placed official in the Arab lobby, contained, quote, raw Jew-baiting, unquote. Entitled, A Strategy to Improve Perceptions of Arabs in the United States, unquote, the secret 81-page proposal contained a massive communications laundry list. This included a coast-to-coast media campaign, press liaisons, a speakers program, nonprofit front organizations, symposia, television and newspaper advertising, posters, bumper stickers, and, quote, everything else, unquote, said this source, again quoting, that had been proposed by other Arab lobbyists for the past 5 years, unquote. The proposal contained more than a dozen separate sections that could be implemented independently and was to cost up to $9 million for 2 years of operations. In the document, excerpts of which I obtained in January of 1983, Gray portrayed support for Israel as exclusively the result of the Israeli lobby's, unquote, manipulations. Quote, "It is the Israeli lobby's ability to politically reward or intimidate American politicians and the media that has led to such intractable support for Israel among U.S. foreign policymakers," unquote. There was no mention at all of the possibility that support for Israel might also be the product of genuine popular sympathy for Israel. The end result of Gray's proposal served to reinforce the notion that a conspiring Zionist cabal controls American public opinion, the media, and Congress. The document continued, quote, "The Israeli lobby's influence, however, goes well beyond its ability to buy friends in Congress with votes or political contributions. There are many other groups in America with larger and more widely dispersed constituencies which even outspend pro-Israeli organizations. Why then is the Israeli lobby so effective? Because those who control the Israeli lobby know how to wield power and use it effectively. The techniques of manipulation of American Middle East policy have been polished and expanded over the last 40 years. Tens of millions of dollars annually are spent in public education and political activities by the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, B'nai B'rith, the American Jewish Congress, Hadassah, and other pro-Israeli groups. Were it not for one other important tactic, even all this would be inconsequential. The Israeli lobby never lobbies for Israel. All of the organizations in the United States which comprise the Israeli lobby, quote, wrap their arguments in an American flag, unquote. They relentlessly present Israel's national interest. Their success in connecting Israel's national interest to U.S. national interest hides the inherent conflict between the two nations and, until now, has prevented a fair debate on the issues, unquote. The document describes how AIPAC, the primary pro-Israel lobbying organization, has operated, quote, a sophisticated classification system, unquote. Gray also wrote, again quoting, that even in districts where there is no significant Jewish voting bloc, candidates are often afraid of being outspoken against Israel for fear of retribution from the Israeli lobby, which does not hesitate to fund an opponent, unquote. According to sources connected with Gray's firm, the document was prepared sometime in the fall of 1982, soon after Gray had landed a $100,000 a month contract with one of the most senior members of the Saudi royal family. He is Prince Talal Abdul Aziz ibn Saud, the 23rd son of the founder of Saudi Arabia, half-brother of King Fahd, and third in succession to the throne. And we're going to take a look now at some of the aspects of American foreign and national security policy, which make for a confusion of foreign policy and which have in turn allowed competing interests to affect American foreign policy and ultimately national security policy. We're going to turn now to the book Dollars for Terror, subtitled The United States and Islam. This book was authored by Richard Labeviere and translated by Martin de Mer. It was published in soft cover by Algora Publishing, and the ISBN number is 1-892-941-06-6. And what we're going to take a look at now is what author Richard Labeviere terms the baklavization of American foreign policy. This is a chapter called Is There a Pilot on Board the U.S. Aircraft or on the U.S. Aircraft? And it reads in part, Big Brother or a Ship Without a Rudder? It's hard to tell, especially when one is analyzing Islamism as seen from Washington. Illustrating the pragmatism inspired by Anglo-Saxon virtues in the field of international relations, an eminent advisor to the State Department today asserts, quote, the need for an incoherent foreign policy, unquote. The same man recognizes off-camera that in these matters the Secret Service has more power than the State Department. By the way, he means the intelligence services here, not the U.S. Secret Service. If you want to understand that, he says, just look at Irangate, a typical scandal. By the way, that was overseen by the elder George Bush. Continuing, although a major shakeup ensued within the U.S. Secret Service, That did not change a thing in terms of the international tribulations of the world's primary power, which continuously oscillates between improvisation with no thought for tomorrow and a carefully constructed Machiavellianism. With the decision-making power split into so many strata, each superimposing its own competing motives onto the issues, U.S. international policy takes on the form of a multi-layered baklava pastry. In this configuration, the intelligence services, including the CIA, play a central role. Many times over, the Central Information Agency, that should be the Central Intelligence Agency, has deliberately pursued its own interests by carrying out its own policy, regardless of any influence from the presidency and the Congress. One of the most disconcerting episodes in this history erupted with the Irangate affair, and the trauma it caused would influence the U.S. government for a long time. Its consequences are still shaping recent evolutions in international policy. The scandal is emblematic of the history of U.S. government because it illustrates a collapse of the baklava structure due to an instance of the CIA's unilateral action vis-à-vis the executive power. Irangate marked a profound rupture. Now we have two eras pre- and post-Irangate. Irangate-Contragate inaugurated a new form of privatization of U.S. foreign policy, carried out via the intermediary of businessmen linked to the services in question. By the way, this book was published in 2000, copyright 2000, and it was originally published in 1999. So this was well in advance of the 2001 attacks. But the dynamics here are very valid indeed. And in addition to petrodollars and the very strong connections through petrodollars to national security elements, including the petroleum faction of the CIA, long story made short, FBI headquarters is named after J. Edgar Hoover. The CIA headquarters building is named after the elder George Bush. Another of the factors that leads to the baklavization of foreign policy, described here very intelligently, I think, by Richard Labeyrière, is the use of fundamentalist religion in order to basically negate the secular state and thereby neutralize individual human rights. And what we're going to look at here in an admittedly ambitious edit is the dovetailing between the right-wing fundamentalist Christians that are a very, very important part of the Republican Party, and the backing of Islamism by powerful multinational corporations, including the petroleum industry and related elements of the intelligence community. Turning once again to dollars for terror, the Islamist ideology mainly seeks to accumulate capital and power. Its totalitarian search for a reinvented identity fits in with American projections particularly well, since it coincides with the expansion of fundamentalism within the U.S., which has been perceptible for two decades. Quote, "This shift was facilitated by the extreme politicization of the televangelist sermon and the increasingly pronounced refusal to separate the spheres of the political and the religious," unquote, explains Dennis Lacan. The very concept of the moral majority, popularized by Jerry Falwell at the end of the 1970s, heralded the collapse of the old, quote, wall of separation, unquote, between the church and the state that was instituted by the founders of the American Republic, unquote. And skipping down, secularity is one of the great achievements of human liberty. By separating the political from the religious, it not only guarantees the cohabitation of several beliefs, but allows the accession to political citizenship regardless of belief. Secularity and democracy are interdependent in the currents of a still-evolving history, and their respective partisans can still invent new twists that respect the beliefs of various groups without contravening the common requirement of, quote, living together, unquote. Skipping down again. The real God hidden behind the illusory God of Islamist ideology is none other than finance and business. The central nerve of Islamism is not Islam, but money. The money and the business of Islamism are rooted these days in the impenetrable global economic networks. This redistribution, which generally takes place with help from organized crime channels, takes advantage of the increased liberalization of investments and financial flows that further restricts the parliamentary procedures and the democratic practices that still remain in Western countries. The same type of alienation that is affected via the Islamist ideology is also gaining momentum via the mechanisms of the global economy. Blending perfectly into the new matrices of organized crime, this neoliberal trend is also accompanied by an accelerated privatization of the foreign policies of the great powers. The trend toward the privatization of foreign policy is further intensified in the U.S. since the various special interest decision makers can work on the domestic level through trade associations and ethnic and religious lobbies that are increasingly powerful. Encouraging a transformation of the relations of power, these new actors are increasingly atomizing the process of political decision-making with a result that is rather similar to that of Islamism. On top of this comes the progressive abandonment of the social protection provisions that formed the pillars of the welfare state for some 30 years. The relations between the political sector, the economic sector, and the citizens have become profoundly upset. This trend, which started with a questioning of the state and a negation of the separation of the political and the religious, now has a profound impact on the possibility of safeguarding a republican public space where various modes of thought and beliefs can coexist. And this is a subject that we're going to take up at greater length, probably in the next broadcast, dealing with Machiavellianism and geopolitics. But into that use of fundamentalist religion to negate the power of the secular state and thereby pave the way for a theocratic fascism, introduce the following, and that's the conception of the Bormann Organization and the SS Capital Organization that we've dealt with in the past in our discussions of Serpent's Walk. This Turner Diaries of the Bormann Organization, so to speak, was authored by one Randolph D. Calverhall, published in soft cover by National Vanguard Books, whose parent organization, the National Alliance, has endorsed September 11th. In this book, there is a conversation between two of the characters, Wrench and Lessing, that describes the SS going underground and consider what they call the corporocracy in the context of the theocratic globalism that you just heard about. Speaking of the SS, they realize that the world is heading toward a corporocracy, 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining, unquote. And indeed, I think that is both abroad and at home. The various broadcasts that I've done over the years, including a long archive show that I would recommend, RFA 37, are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email, mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. Website at spitfirelist.com. There will be a detailed and annotated description of For the Record 345 in that website within a couple of days of the recording of this program. Sister station WFMU-FM has been archiving the For the Record programs on Real Audio at wfmu.org/Dave Emory, D-A-V-E-E-M-O-R-Y. This concludes For the Record program 345. Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Part 2, Nation Building in the United States. This is being recorded on January 27th of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.